So don't get scared. Anyway, nature will choose only one thing, hopefully, or not a combination of extra dimensions, supersymmetry, and different dimensions. Hopefully not. Hopefully there will be one thing, and then we can settle down to study and understand properly this theory. But now, today we start with some new, and I think it's also very exciting proposal for beyond the standard model. Is the idea of models of extra dimensions. So another way of addressing, as usual, the naturalness problems of the standard model is to say, okay, what we say is in SUSY is to extend the of space-time. Adding, actually, what we were doing in supersymmetry is actually adding more symmetries, but those symmetries were fermionic, so they behave as new fermionic dimensions. Why do I say this? We didn't go in detail into the formalism of supersymmetry, but adding these generators, Q and Q bar, can be formally expressed as having new dimensions that are denoted generally theta and theta bar. And there is a formalism in supersymmetry of Kolob superfields in superspace, where now the superspace is x mu, theta, and theta bar. And now when you do an integration over d4x, you also do an integration over theta and over theta bar, where these guys are formally new dimensions of space-time, but they are fermionic. As I said, we didn't go into all these details because that will take months and months and months. To really understand. But there is a way of expressing supersymmetry that is formally as having a superspace, where now instead of having four dimensions of space-time, we have two new dimensions, but those are fermionic. That's supersymmetry. So SUSY is adding new symmetries of space-time. We say that those were the maximal extensions of the Poincaré symmetry, and that's what we meant by that, is that you can think on QQ bar as being actually the charges, the conserved charges of new dimensions of, if you want translations on these dimensions that are fermionic. The same way that P mu is the charge or is the generator corresponding to invariants under translations over X mu. Okay. But now we don't care about SUSY anymore. We are going to talk about new actual dimensions of space-time. So they are new bosonic, real dimensions of space-time, the same way you think about dimensions in four dimensions. So that's a possibility. It could be that there are. And in other words, why do we have four dimensions? Why three space and one time dimension? Why? Why is this number and not any other number of dimensions? Obviously, there are models out there trying to explain why four. But at the end of the day, you look at theories with, for example, that try to unify gravity with gauge theories and so on and so forth, such as string theory. Those theories tend to, well, they are defined in spaces, in space-time, with dimensions bigger than four. Depending on what kind of theory you're looking at, is 12, 10, 11, and then you have to compactify down to 4. So the idea is that if there are new dimensions of space-time, because we tested Newtonian dynamics, if you want Newtonian. GR, special relativity, and all these things. And they seem to be compatible with 4 dimensions. If there are new dimensions of space-time, it means that they had to be hidden. Extra dimensions, the dimensions beyond 4D need to be hidden. We've had to find a way to have these dimensions, but the final reason why we haven't seen them in this kind of test. And the usual assumption is that these extra dimensions are compactified. So you can think of extra dimensions, if you want, as instead of being an infinitely large dimension, it's a dimension of a small size. And that's the reason why we haven't seen any effect of extra dimensions yet. So extra dimensions need to be compactified. And that's what the string theory does. It starts with a bunch of dimensions and then finds way of compactifying, because at the end of the day, if a string theory is has anything to do with nature, it better be that leads to 4 dimensions at the end of the day, at low energies. Okay. So you probably heard about the landscape of string theory. This is related to this fact, the fact that you can find many, many, many ways of going from 10 dimensions, or 11 or 12, to 4. And all these different compactifications or ways of dealing, or at the end of the day, at low energies, we want to recover the standard model. We know the standard model is right. It's a model in 4 dimensions. So if a string theory or any theory of higher dimensions is a description of nature, it better be that the low energy description of those theories is the standard model for dimensions. Yes?
Can we actually get the standard model from this compactification?
Not that we know of. But the idea of the landscape, I don't believe in the landscape or anything like this, but the idea of the landscape is that the number of vacua is of this order. So it may be that in one of these vacua, we don't know which one, there is a standard model.
So the landscape is often cited as a reason why string theory is not predictive.
Yes.
But it seems that if you have not found the standard model vacua yet, then it is predictive in some sense.
I don't know why. You can, this is a class, right? We can discuss. Why do you think so?
Suppose you find a one vacuum in which the subset is a standard model, then that vacuum will predict what the high energy physics is going to
be. Indeed. Okay, so what you're saying is that so far, among these 10 to the 500 people looking for the standard model, they haven't found it.
Right.
You're saying that because there are so many possibilities and very few of them could lead to the standard model,
perhaps
once we find one example, we know the way up.
Right.
I agree.
But V88 doesn't contain the standard model?
No. You need to have a low energy description with no exotic matter, not a number of Higgses. You need to have one or two. No, it doesn't, unfortunately. So yes.
So my question, how do you really know that the extra dimensions have to be compactified? Couldn't you have some model in which, say, gravity doesn't propagate into the extra dimensions as well?
Where is gravity?
It's a
good
that's
question. But then you have to think back of where is gravity?
I'm saying
when you say
modify general relativity in such a way that it doesn't talk to the extra dimension.
But then I'm going back to the same question. What is gravity? What do you mean by propagating in the extra dimensions? You are assuming that it's a graviton, the mediator of the gravitational force. If there is the the meaning of a real dimension of space-time is then you need to have gravity because the geometry defines this extra dimension. And once you put the geometry, so g mu nu, the gravity is just expanding over that. It's the fluctuations around your background. So if there is an extra dimension, it has a description in terms of a geometry, and then the fluctuations are the gravity. So gravity must live in all these dimensions.
Even if I impose that the extra direction is always flat?
Still, you will have a, like that will be, if you want Minkowski in this extra dimension, that you will still have gravitational fluctuations. But as you know, it's an interesting question because I'm going to tell you in a second that actually one thing I'm very interested about is that sometimes you use extra dimensions as if they were real dimensions, but they are not. You use extra dimensions as a hologram of a strongly coupled theories, such as Technicolor. In that case, this extra dimension is a tool, it's not a real dimension. So in that case, gravity doesn't propagate in this extra dimension. So for example, extra dimensions can be described with something called deconstruction. It's another set of models. These deconstructed models are just a lattice. You take a lattice for your extra dimension. And this is just a tool, it's not real an extra dimension, and you don't have gravity propagating in it. So all these questions are there, yes. But so in this lecture, we are just going to talk about new dimensions of space-time that are real dimensions, meaning that gravity propagates on them. That's the only prediction. Did I answer your question, Andrew? Okay, good. So the possibilities out there is some motivation if you want from string theory. We don't need a string theory to motivate new dimensions of space-time because we already did it for supersymmetry. It's new for many dimensions of space-time, so why not? What is cool is that once you start considering new dimensions of space-time, then you obtain new ways of stabilizing the electroweak scale. And I'm going to just go roughly over them, and then we will discuss them in detail. At least some of them. So one of them is, why is the electroweak scale difficult to stabilize? Because we always have high scales out there. So we get these kind of corrections, and we want to keep this guy near the electroweak scale, whereas this guy can be as large as the largest scale. So one solution.
What is NP for?
New physics.
Sorry.
No, thank you. Ask me this kind of question. New physics. One way of avoiding the problem altogether is to say that this, the highest scale that we can think about in quantum field theory is actually TeV. Or in other words, we want to say that M Planck, the fundamental M Planck is actually TeV. And we are going to explain how we get that. But that's a way of avoiding problems. We think there are all these high energies order M Planck, orders and orders of magnitude beyond the TeV scale. But actually, maybe there aren't. What is M Planck? M Planck is the scale at which quantum gravity effects become important. And we think, oh, we don't care about quantum gravity because it's up there, the M Planck scale. So in extra dimensions, you can make it such that the fundamental Planck scale is actually TeV. So there is no scales beyond TeV, in the sense that already at the TeV scale we get a strong gravity. So then it's a matter of test. Yes.
So I mean, I've heard this, especially in Cliff Burgess's talks. It seems to me that then, if fundamental Planck, the Planck scale is right around the corner, then we should expect, you know, quantum gravity effects such as black holes and things like that.
Yes.
In colliders or
yes.
things like that.
Yes.
In the near future.
Exactly.
Wow.
And that's your homework, actually. So you're going to get a homework on Friday. It's about producing black holes at colliders. So yeah, that's cool. They better evaporate. So it's, in a way, it's cool because, you know, all these questions, interesting questions of quantizing gravity or not, or black holes productions and stuff like this, are going to be at the TeV scale, and we can reach these energies. Whereas in the common law scenario, in Planck is 10 to the 18 GeV, who cares? So here we had this opportunity of having to deal with a strong gravity. A more conservative person will say, oh, that's terrible because my beautiful quantum field theory that works all the way to the Planck scale now has a cutoff at the TeV scale. And then I have no clue of what happens beyond the TeV scale. So it's a loss or an opportunity, whatever you want to see. I think it's probably crazy, no way this is happening, but you know, it's cool to study. So that's one way around. There is no, whichever.
First,
okay.
So would this be compatible with cosmology?
Yes, a very good question. So what do you know of cosmology? What is the first thing that has to happen in cosmology? Vivan, and then
inflation.
And how low can be inflation in terms of energy? Or how late? You don't need to know, it's not well known, but given the actual constraints on inflation, inflation can happen even as late as the BBN. The inflation could be at the electroweak scale. As far as we know, it could be at the electroweak scale. Not to mention that in extra dimensions, cosmology changes, and there are other ways of doing things. But as what we know for dimensional cosmology, inflation can be BBN. Pretty cool, eh? We always think of inflation up there. It could be just at the TeV scale. We are just pulling our system. Now,
so in this M Planck, which is kind of TeV, so how many dimensions do we need for that?
We are going to describe that. You need a further to avoid other experiments. It could be one. It just happens to be. So we are going to study two types of models of extra dimensions. Flat extra dimensions, large extra dimensions, where you need at least two extra dimensions, so 6D. The other model that I think is more interesting is a Randall-Sundrum or warped extra dimensions. To achieve an M Planck, effective M Planck of order TeV, you just need one. But then the fundamental scale is actually M Planck, it's not TeV. So do not worry for the moment. To get really a fundamental M Planck order TeV, you need at least two extra dimensions. You're going to see that. Okay, so that's a way out. So, one of the cool things about this is that you can produce black holes or any strong gravity effects could be reachable with colliders. Cool, great. Okay. Any chance of that? Don't worry. The experimentalists at the LHC are looking for black holes. And you're going to do a homework about that. It could also be that the Higgs is part of a gauge field living in the bulk of an extra dimension. Well, this is now the gauge field. M is an index that goes from 0 to d minus 1. So it's a gauge field in d dimensions. And the idea is that this gauge field contains your regular four-dimensional gauge field, the photon, for example, and the extra-dimensional component, the E5, is more or less your Higgs. So what is going to happen in this picture is that you start with a higher-dimensional gauge field. You are going to compactify the extra dimensions, so you can arrange a situation where the four-dimensional gauge field is still massless, but then this guy gets a mass, the fifth component, but it's a mass that is protected because actually this A5, after compactification, is a pseudo-Gorston boson.
Boson?
Yes, yes.
Is it only for one extra dimension?
You could do a 5 or 6, and you can do as many as you want. And then, so you could have a 5, you have 6 dimensions, a 6, and so on and so forth. And then the Higgs will be the lightest guy among all these, the lightest combination. Yes.
Why do we call Higgs A5? Why not A4?
Ah, yes. Sorry. My notation sucks. I'm not using the notation that everybody uses. So we do 0, 1, 2, 3, and then we jump to 5.
Right.
Sorry. It sucks. That's probably why you were asking, right? 5, 6, and so on. Yes. So you can think of the Higgs as an A5 in an extra dimension. And why is this cool? It's because it provides a natural mechanism for the Higgs to be a pseudo-Gorston boson.
Question?
Yes.
Well, it's just, so this gauge field has only 1 degree of field, right?
In one sense.
Oh, okay. I mean, in the point that that you need 2 degrees of freedom for the Higgs.
Ah, okay. So you're saying with this guy, I'm just going to get a neutral component. I won't get the doublet. That's two. Yes, you have to do something else to get the charge component. Yes.
When you said that if you have more of them, then the lightest is the case. What do you mean by the lightest?
Yes. So if I have a 5 or 6, to be specific, very popular models of gauge Higgs unification actually have a 6 extra dimensions. Six dimensions, and the A5 and A6 are the components in the fifth and the sixth dimension. And why people are interested in this is because there is a term of gauge interaction between these two that is very helpful to give a potential to the Higgs. So it's not going to be simply A5 or A6, it's going to be a linear combination of them, because there are interactions, and those guys can get waves, then it's going to be a little bit more complicated. But whichever it is, the lightest guy is going to be a pseudo-Gorston boson.
But lightest after symmetry picking.
After symmetry.
By using that lightest particle.
Yes. After symmetry breaking, so, well, after compactification.
So you would guess that you take any of them and then, you could choose any of the components because there's nothing special about the site.
So each of them is, all this depends on how you compactify, because you have 2 extra dimensions, you can do many things. You can compactify them in the simplest way in a torus.
So if I do some very complicated compactification,
yes.
Then in principle I would have to go through all the possible cases and see which one gives me the lightest particle.
Exactly. So you can complicate your life, yes. So in this case, in the gauge Higgs unification, the idea is that the gauge symmetry, that the d-dimensional gauge symmetry, after compactification, leads to 4D gauge symmetry plus a bunch of shift symmetries. which would lead to the presence of Goldstone bosons, so pseudo Goldstone bosons. So that's the way it works. You start with a very large symmetry in extra dimensions. You break it down using compactification, but this compactification doesn't break down completely the extra dimensional symmetries. It keeps some of them in terms of shift symmetries. Yes?
So the shift symmetries are related to the isometries of the torus.
Yes.
So this is particular to the torus, right?
You can, as I was telling Andrew, you can do many ways, right?
But would we get a shift symmetry?
Yes. Like, for example, you could compactify one of them being very large, but warped, the other very small and completely flat. Yeah, the possibilities are infinite. Okay. At least it's not 10 to the 500 as far as we know. Okay. So this is a cool idea because, as you see here, this is independent or having extra dimensions. This is a particular realization of the Higgs as a pseudo-Goldstone boson, or in other words, it's a particular way of achieving what is called a composite, or composite, I never know how to pronounce it, Higgs. The same idea that is in little Higgs, so same as little Higgs. So in little Higgs, you impose the symmetry as to be there. In the Higgs as a pseudo-Goldstone boson, as the extra dimensional component of some gauge fields, the symmetry appears naturally as a remnant of the very large gauge symmetry group in extra dimensions. Yes.
Has anybody proved that we can actually find our own standard model in these?
No. I mean, otherwise you will have headlines. String theory solves the. It's the theory of nature. No, and that's why it's after 30 years, it's a little bit. Yes. Anyway, it's. If anything else, string theory has been inspiring lots of model building. Been useful in any case. Okay. So that's another way of using extra dimensions. It's a way of writing down theories for little Higgs or for the Higgs as a pseudo-Goldstone boson or composite Higgs. And now that it may be that the Higgs is down there, well, if the Higgs is at 126 GeV, it's pretty light, and either we have Susie, or we have pseudo-Goldstone bosons. I don't know what else to do, personally. Precisely, because we don't know what else to do, probably we need young people like you guys coming up with new ideas, because we run out of ideas. The third thing we can do is to use these extra dimensional models as tools to compute things. What as tools to compute things in strongly coupled theories. Such as Technicolor. Technicolor, you want to. What people have in mind when they say Technicolor changes from physicist to physicist. Some people think on Technicolor as the simplest version of rescale QCD, no Higgs, nothing, extra resonances. Other people think on Technicolor as just using this idea of strong interactions as to break spontaneously symmetries. That's my way of thinking. So you can say that Technicolor is ruled out. 20 years ago because of the electrobeam precision tests, but that means that a particular version of Technicolor, an application of this idea, is ruled out, at least for in my language. So now, in this kind of picture, the Higgs It's a scalar resonance of some strongly coupled theory, of some technicolor theory. And to understand the Higgs, we need to understand the technicolor theory. Boy, this is very, very hard, especially if it has, it's very different from QCD. We have no clue of what to do, or at least I don't. So often what we do is to, instead of dealing with technicolor, we build a dictionary. We call this dictionary the ADS-CFD dictionary. ADS is a geometry, is a way you can write a space-time, anti-de-Sitter. CFT means conformal field theory. So this is anti-de-Sitter. That's ADS. And CFT is conformal field theory. And the idea of this holographic approach is to say, I don't know how to deal with technicolor directly. Technicolor is a strongly coupled theory. But if I think that technicolor is resembles a conformal field theory in any way, then I can use an anti-de-Sitter weakly coupled description of gravity, and then draw this analog between technicolor and extra-dimensional theories in ADS, in anti-de-Sitter. So we are going to learn a lot about extra dimensions in anti-de-Sitter. That's the Randall-Sundin model. But I just want you to keep in mind that those extra-dimensional theories do have an analog in terms of some strongly coupled theories. And the way to write the analog is using this dictionary of the ADS-CFD. This is inspired on the string theory, but it's just a qualitative statement. Yes?
So are we, do we expect, so basically you're saying that technicolor, there are resonances for some higher demand, for some higher energy quantum field theory, but is there any assurance why that should be a conformal theory?
No. So technicolor, imagine that technicolor is really the way we break electroweak symmetry. If this technicolor theory has no behavior that looks like a conformal field theory, we are screwed. We need to do lattice. We need to do non-perturbative, real non-perturbative numerical things, which is not that thing I want to do.
Right.
Now, I can tell you that in my experience, even QCD can be described very well by a conformal field theory. So when I do an ADS dual of QCD, it works extremely well. So maybe the technicolor works.
So who introduced the ADS version of QCD?
Oh, three groups, including myself. Yes.
But if you want to model technicolor with ADS CFT, you have, well, I mean, you're not having a CFT anymore because you have to have a compactification share, right? So
yes.
Then
no, well, yes. So the compactification is breaking the conformal theory, but part of the dictionary precisely is to tell you what is the effect of this, of breaking spontaneously and explicitly the conformal symmetry. Yeah. So it's not a, it's a CFT when we start adding stuff, and that's why we need a dictionary. So the ADS CFT originally is a theory of n equals 4 super Young-Mills. Dual to a particular compactification of a type 2B supergravity in some limit, right? So it's really, well, in ADS 5 times S5. The ADS CFT is a duality that has been proven in this particular set of theories that are highly symmetric and highly useless. So what I'm saying is that what people do these days is to learn some lessons from this ADS-CFT, and they still call it ADS-CFT, but it's just using this dictionary and trying to encode part of the behavior we want from the technicolor theory into some extra-dimensional model. this is risky business, as you can imagine, because we don't know a way of computing here. And whenever this theory is computable, this one becomes strongly coupled and vice versa. But at least it gives us some tools. The extra dimension in this case is a tool to try to obtain information about the strongly coupled theory. And this is better than nothing. OK, so that's some ways in which we use extra dimensions. So you can believe on extra dimensions as being right there, making gravity strong at the TEV scale. You can think on extra dimensions as being very tiny, but still accessible at the Large Hadron Collider. You can think on extra dimensions as being just tools that you use to compute theories that we have no other way of accessing. I don't have any particular belief, so anything works. Now, what is the problem number one with extra-dimensional theories? The problem number one with extra-dimensional theories is the problem number one for quantum gravity, is that it is non-renormalizable. So we are going to see why explicitly, but remember, the standard model is a quantum field theory in four dimensions that is renormalizable. And here we are trying to extend the standard model, go beyond, and what we are doing, and I'm going to explain why, is to lead to theories that are non-renormalizable. How bad is that? You don't care. Tibet doesn't care. Anybody care? A non-renormalizable theory is no big deal as long as you have a good description of your effective theory. And you know exactly where the effects of this theory... I'm okay with non-renormalizable as long as there is a predictive effective theory. And this effective theory will have a natural cutoff. And as long as I know this effective theory and I can work with it, and I know the cutoff, I'm okay with that. But the standard model is much more ambitious than that. Right? It's a quantum field theory, four dimensions, validity all the way up to infinity if it wasn't for gravity. So here we are giving up some stuff. Just keep that in mind. And that's often the reason why some people didn't want to work on extra dimensions, because they are non-renormalizable. So let me explain why they are non-renormalizable. Let's take a theory in D bigger than 4. We write the action as being the integral, or we had to integrate over the four dimensions, and we also had to integrate over the extra dimensions. So let me call D 4 plus n, when n is the number of extra dimensions. So the action comes from, I take the integral over the whole volume, and then, for example, I write a kinetic term for my scalar. So that's a scalar theory in d dimensions. Now m is this index that runs from 0 to 3 and then it jumps until n. OK. So let's look at dimensions of this guy. What are the mass dimensions of the actions? What do you do with the action? What do you do with the action, actually? Is the thing that you put in some exponential with an I or not, depending on Euclidean and Minkowski, right? So the guy has no mass dimensions because it appears in an exponential. OK, so the action doesn't have any dimensions. So how many dimensions we have here of mass? Always, when I ask about dimensions, I mean that. Ali? 4 plus n with a minus sign because we want to look at mass dimensions. Okay. So what are the dimensions of this guy?
4 plus n.
Thank you. I know it's evident, but please answer me, otherwise I get worried. Okay, so that's 4 plus n. So if we look at the scalar theory, just looking at the kinetic terms, we can then obtain what are the dimensions of the scalar field. Because the dimensions of the fields in different space-time dimensions are different. So what are the dimensions of this derivative? So that's 1, right? This derivative gives you 1 plus twice the dimensions of the scalar, which, sorry, had to sum up to this guy. Is it clear? Okay? So with that, you can obtain what are the dimensions of your scalar field. A scalar field in D dimensions, where D is 4 plus n, has mass dimensions of pi 1 plus n over 2. So obviously in D equals 4, in 4 dimensions is 1, in 5 dimensions is 3 halves. It has the same dimensions as the fermions. Okay. Okay. This is the way you always had to do. You look at the kinetic terms. You know the kinetic terms should be canonically normalized. Look at the action and then obtain what are the engineering dimensions of the field. Now, let's add a potential for the scalar field. Your potential is going to look, for example, like a mass term plus some quartic. So we look at this potential and we wonder if in D dimensions this guy is going to lead to renormalizable and renormalizable theory. So what are the dimensions of this guy? It's 2 plus, in this case, 2 plus n, which is 4 plus n. So this theory with a mass term is still renormalizable in D dimensions. The same way that turns up to order 4 is still renormalized. Okay. Now about these interactions. We are going to find the dimensions of lambda are going to be 4 plus 2n. Let me go slower. So the question is that we have to add this potential inside this integral. So you will have a term that will look as d4x, dnz, where z are the x dimensions, d of phi. And we know already that that goes as 4 plus n, these terms. And now in this potential, we add a lambda phi 4. And we know the dimensions of phi. So the dimensions of this volume integration, the dimensions of lambda plus 4 times the dimensions of the scalar field had to lead to 0. With that, we obtain the dimensions of the quartic coupling. And this is negative. Where is this back? So when we find a coupling that it has negative mass dimensions, we see that we are going to end up with a problem of renormalizability. The reason is imagine that I want to compute any cross section or any process in these extra dimensions. The cross section will be proportional to some mass matrix square. So imagine that I want to compute a cross section of this kind of scattering, or phi scattering, using this quartic coupling. But now the quartic coupling is in extra dimensions, so this sigma is going to be proportional to lambda squared. And then I'm going to need something that offsets the mass dimensions of this guy. So I'm going to end up with something that goes as the energy to 2n.
We can't really see that.
Until you look at the rest of the terms, I agree.
We can't really see that part of the problem.
Okay, let me do it here. Once I have a coupling constant that is has negative mass dimensions, I'm in trouble, because whenever I want to compute a physical process, in that case, a scattering of the scalar field. Because now the coupling has mass dimensions, lambda has dimensions of minus n, then any process will go as lambda squared, but to offset the dimensions, I need energy to 2n. So this theory, if I keep producing scattering at higher and higher energies, this theory is going to end up breaking unitarity. I'm going to end up with a probability bigger than 1. The same way that in the Fermi theory, when you write down this Fermi theory of a muon, an electron, neutrino, neutrino, you write here the coupling is GF, and this guy has mass dimensions, inverse mass dimensions. This theory, we knew it had to be wrong at some point, is an effective theory precisely because of the same reason. When the coupling has mass dimensions, negative mass dimensions, then any scattering you do, you keep doing it at higher and higher energies, you end up with something violating unitarity or the conservation of probability. So that violates unitarity, or in other words, conservation of probability. Okay. The same way that the Fermi theory is a non-renormalizable theory, this theory in extra dimensions is non-renormalizable. Now, can we use Fermi theory? Yes, knowing that it's an effective theory valid up to the W mass. Can we use extra dimensional theories? Yes, knowing what is the cutoff of this theory. Okay, so that's the problem number one, is we know this theory won't hold forever, and we are forced to do something about the theory at some point.
A question?
Yes.
You made a cross section three dimensions
now? Yes.
Shouldn't it have an area?
Sorry?
Shouldn't it be an area?
An area, the hype. I don't know how to explain this in a simple way. What I can tell you is that I know my cross section essentially is measuring the probability of interaction. I know that we express it in nanobars or in barns, and this is an area in centimeters squared. But at the end of the day, it's just a probability. That's what we are looking at. So I'm going to compute the probability of this process at some given energy. This is a dimensionless quantity. And in my scattering, I know that I already have something with dimensions of mass, and the only other scale I can use to offset the dimensions is energy, the energy of the scattering. So I end up, no matter what you do, with this combination. And because it's a positive power of energy, I know at some point I'm going to screw up. Okay. Same is for gauge interactions. And this is not a particular of scalar fields in extra dimensions. Gauge interactions also lead to non-renormalizable theory. So if we add to the picture of gauge interactions, then our action is going to contain some integration over the volume. And then the only gauge invariant quantity, which is F squared. For now, F squared is Fmn. Fmn is the generalization or your usual tensor for electrodynamics, but in n dimensions, in d dimensions. Okay. So what does F contain? This guy contains derivatives of the fields square, right? So this guy contains the integral over the volume times something that looks like derivative of the field square. And just looking at these pieces, we can obtain what are the dimensions. Again, this is 4 plus n plus each of these guys gives you 2 plus the dimensions of A. But the dimensions of A has to lead to 0. So in d dimensions, the dimensions of A are the same as 5. It's just 1 plus n over 2. So now if we go back to our scalar theory and we decide to charge this scalar under these vector interactions, then what we will do is to take, this derivative and do a covariant derivative. Right? So my covariant derivative is going to contain terms of, for example, the gauge coupling in the dimensions, the field, a derivative of the scalar, and another scalar, right? So this is contained here in the derivative. With this, we can obtain what is the dimension of GD. And what you obtain is that the dimension of your gauge coupling, so from terms of 5 GD, A derivative 5. And you obtain that the dimensions of GD are minus n over 2. Again, negative mass dimensions will lead to a non-renormalizable theory, and we are in trouble in that case. So theories in extra dimensions are non-renormalizable. There's no way around.
Susie,
yes?
I doubt whether this analysis will be available. Suppose your extra dimensions is compacted by.
Yes.
Because I think you don't get a continuous degree of freedom in the momentum space corresponding to the extra.
So the again. In the momentum space into the extra dimension, right? Yes. Okay, so what's your name, sir?
Ernest.
What he's saying is that the momentum in a compactified state dimension is proportional to some integer divided by the radius of compactification. So you are wondering if this may change this issue of renormalizability. Is that what you're saying? The problem is that n runs from 0 or 1 to infinity. So it's true that the momentum is quantized, but it is not bounded by a rule. So we can reach higher and higher energies. So you were wondering if, because now the momentum has to have particular values, there I can avoid the problem. The problem is not that the particular values of the energy. The problem is that the energy can run as high as I want. So I know at some point I'm going to violate unitarity. Yeah, but that's a good point, yes. All right, cool. So the star-dimensional theories are non-renormalizable. What do we do with that? It seems that you don't care so much. It's good. You are young. If you were an old bugger like me, you would think, oh, it's terrible. We lose predictivity. Yes, we had to live with an effective theory. We had to live with a cutoff. But that's the way life is. So one approach to extra dimensions is to throw them away. We don't care. Another approach of extra dimensions is I can use extra dimensions only in a classical way. Yes?
So we didn't have any other problems rather than non-renormalizability?
Well, we have to compactify them. That's complete. You mean besides aesthetical issues?
Yeah.
I don't think so. Okay. Not that I can think about.
So why did you call it problem number one?
Ah, you mean that word is not? Good question, Ali. I don't know why I call it problem number one. It's the problem of extra dimensions. I guess it's the question number one you get when you work on this kind of stuff and you give a seminar in a place where people are quite old. That's, well, I thought the extra dimensions are not renormalizable. And you say, oh, yes, I know that. Yes.
So when you compactify it, do you need some mechanism to keep them stable?
Yes. Yes. So what's that? Jacob?
Yes,
Jacob. He's saying, cool, so you imagine that you start with the dimensions and that with four, and the extra n dimensions are compactified. But how do you do that? And worse than that, once you compactify, let's say I have made a circle of one of them, why the radius of this circle is going to stay like this? So I'm creating a surface for this compactified state dimension. And the natural tendency is to grow, obviously, most of the time, or to shrink. But why will it stay precisely at this radius? That's a big issue. Yes. Yes.
Could we not have flux quantization?
Yes, that's one way of solving it. In Randall-Sundo, for example, there is a mechanism called the Goldberger-Wise mechanism. So there are ways of doing that. But it's some question you have to address. More questions? Cool. So one way is to use it classically, the same as you use gravity in a classical way. And the other way is to even do loops. If you want to do loops, do loops of an effective theory, knowing that there is a cutoff up there. In, for example, in chiral perturbation theory, the theory of pions and kaons in QCD, we do loops, but it's the loops of an effective theory, so you have to regularize them in a particular way. Okay. So let me just do one simple thing, and we continue tomorrow. So in practice, you take your extra dimensions, you compactify them. As Jacob was saying, well, how do I maintain these extra dimensions at the size I want? This is a question. But once you do that, how do you describe your fields in terms? So your fields are now five-dimensional fields. I know I'm doing something funny to n of the extra n of the dimensions. How do I account for that compactification? And what is more important, how do I measure that my theory in d dimensions end up giving me an effective theory in four dimensions that is the real one? What I mean is that we know for sure there are some low energies below the compactification scale. I shouldn't see any effect of the extra dimension. How do I do that? Well, that you do a Kaluza-Klein compactification. Just do a quick thing. So we take again our action for the scalar field, the 4x. Let me just do one extra dimension for simplicity. So it goes from 0 to the length of the extra dimension. Let's call it pi r. And now I have my scalar theory with the proper terms in front. That's my scalar theory in five dimensions. Oops. Yes. So remember when I use up and down notation, what I'm doing is I take my derivative and I multiply by, let's say, n, by nm. And this is what we call the derivative with the index up, right? So remember that when we do this contraction of indices, there is a metric here hidden. Okay? So you have to tell me what is the metric in the extra dimensions. So let's assume.
So,
yes.
So by the same token, should you not have a minus square root of g?
Yes, you should. Yes. This volume is not invariant, so you need to add a minus. Sorry. The determinant of g. Indeed. Cool. So there is a factor here of the metric. There is also factors of the metric whenever you have contraction of indices. So remember that. Oops. So for this case, we are going to assume flat extra dimensions or Minkowski, where GMN is just 1 minus 1 minus 1 minus 1 until the end of the day. OK, so that's a simple one. So we want to take this action, vary it, and then obtain the equations of motion for the scalar. How do we do that? Well, so we do delta m, and this guy is going to contain integral over the volume of the variation of the kinetic term minus the derivative with respect to the field of this guy. All right. So now what we want to make sure is that we obtain the equations of motion in 4D, the usual scalar equations of motion in 4D. So you can write down this as being the integral over the volume and integrate by parts as to obtain something that looks like minus dm dm of 5 minus dv d 5 delta 5. And I integrated by parts and I end up with a boundary term, which is now is an integral over the volume, now the d4x of dz the phi delta of phi. And now those are boundary terms that go from zero to the length of the extra dimension. So whenever you have a few minutes, do this math, or maybe it's a part of the tutorial actually. But the question is that you start with this kind of action, variation, and you rewrite it as a term that looks like the equations of motion. So you get rid of this derivative of delta of phi. But then you end up with boundary terms in the usual four dimensions. Those boundary terms, you get rid of them because you assume that the fields at infinity are zero. That's what you usually do. But then you also get boundary terms on the extra dimension. And there, the fields at there is no fields at infinity. It's the fields at the extra dimension, which is a finite value. And the reason why I wanted to do this is to tell you that, OK, so we want to use this. This equals zero will be the equations of motion. And we need to get rid of these boundary terms. So the way to get rid of these boundary terms, did I do it right? Yes. There are two ways. Either I set the derivative on the boundaries to be zero, or I set the value of the field to be zero. So the boundary terms vanish if one possibility is that the derivative of the field at the boundary is zero, another possibility is that the field itself is zero. The boundary is zero. So those are called,
sorry,
those are boundary conditions. Yes, yes.
Can't it be closed? I mean, we have
Yes, so you could do that. Here I'm considering, depends on how you compactify essentially. What I'm considering is it's an interval. So I have an extra dimension. This extra dimension is just a line. It goes from 0 to n, and I call n pi r. I'm using the interval because it's the simplest version of extra dimensions that we use for model building. Yeah, indeed, there are other ways using antiperiodic or periodic orbifolding. Befolding. Debra?
So the only delta
finds to
be zero, right?
Yes, so we want to make sure that this goes to zero.
So the second condition, you said phi is at boundary zero, you want delta phi?
No, I want the field itself, and obviously the delta is going to be zero as well.
But we can have a fixed value.
Then if it's a fixed value, it falls here. So you mean that the field could be constant in the extra dimension? And I agree. And then if it's constant, then you take derivatives, you also get zero. So those are called, and this guy is Neumann, boundary conditions. Those are called Dirichlet boundary conditions. I am going to call them plus boundary conditions and minus boundary conditions. I am going to call them because model builders for electroweak symmetry breaking use this notation too. And you will use it in your tutorial. Okay, so with those boundary conditions, you make sure that those boundary terms in the extra dimension vanish, and then your equations of motion are this. Those are your equations of motion in extra dimensions. Tomorrow we are going to look at these equations of motion and do the Kaluza-Klein decomposition. So that will be tomorrow.